This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com. Good day, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland HedgeGhoul. And this is your HedgeGhoul Master, Tommy Graham, editor of History Ireland Magazine. And we would like to acknowledge the support of the Commemorations Unit of the Department of Culture, Heritage and the Gaeltacht. Now, this is our first HedgeGhoul done as a podcast. We're on the frontiers of technology here. This HedgeGhoul is also in association with Galway Trades Council. Originally, this was meant to be a May Day event in the Mechanics Institute in Galway, our favourite venue, if only because they have a lovely little bar at one end of the hall. Oh, what would I give for a creamy pint right now? Ooh, that'll have to wait. Anyway, I digress. Now, because of the day that's in it, May Day, we are looking at Soviet strikes and land seizures, class conflict and the Tan War. And we have assembled a stellar panel here. So representing the City of the Tribes, we have John Cunningham and we have Sarah Ann Buckley, both of NUIG Galway. We have Mary Muldowney, who's one of Dublin City Council's historians in residence. And finally, Brian Hanley, soon to be of Trinity College Dublin. You're all very welcome. Now, just to get things started, right, to what extent was social radicalism part of the Irish Revolutionary Project? And I'm thinking here in particular of, say, the 1916 proclamation. Brian.
I think the aspiration to social change was part of the revolution and played a part in the motivations of a lot of people who took part in those years. But in terms of an actual desire for social change, I think that took very much second place to a desire for sovereignty. And there's the 1916 proclamation and so on. What it's mainly about is the declaration of a republic and a declaration of independence from Britain. It can be read by those who want to as aspiring to social change in terms of the ownership of Ireland, resting with the people of Ireland and so on. But that's suitably vague to appeal to anybody. And I think in general, the motivating factor that united what was a coalition up till the end of the War of Independence, at least, was the desire for sovereignty. Now, within that, you had a whole range of political beliefs and you had a whole spectrum of things going on, sometimes connected to the independence struggle, sometimes quite independent of it, so to speak, whereby people did try to seize land, people took part in strike action and so on for economic reasons. And this was all tied up then in a general tumult, which can't be separated from that which was going on across the world at the time.
Just before I get on to the 1920 era, just to go back to the question of social radicalism and sovereignty, the point is, though, isn't sovereignty and class intertwined in the Irish situation for the very reason, for example, if you look at the land question, right, the fact that the you know, landowners in general were people of a different ethnic origin. You know what I mean? So there is a link there. Can maybe, John, do you want to come in on that? Because I think this bears on our later discussion. This whole area is riddled with misunderstanding, it seems to me. There is a link. There isn't a contradiction between class and sovereignty. There is in some cases, but not always. Yes.
I suppose if we go back to Sam Clarke in his writings on the land question in particular, he spoke about for rebellion to take place, there needed to be discontent and leadership. So, and we have the whole Parnell talking about using the land question to drive the Home Rule engine. I'm sure I'm misquoting it. But you do have those two distinct factors, I suppose. And certainly the discontent is generally socially radical in the way it's expressed, even if we go back to the 19th century. And I think we can say that too in relation to the period of that we're talking about today, that discontent, social discontent, social radicalism it was a driving force, if you like.
Sarah, can I bring in you there in relation to the proclamation? Because that's what I say most listeners are familiar with in terms of laying out a revolutionary programme. And I suppose you've answered this question several times, the reference to children in the proclamation. Could you clear that up with us? Because you've done a lot of work on that.
Yeah, I guess the question of, you know, cherishing the children of the nation equally, I think most scholars would now agree that that was a reference to all citizens on the island, and meant to be a more inclusive reference as opposed to talking about actual children. For me, I guess, coming in where Brian was discussing the proclamation, which we'll connect later when we discuss the democratic program, the equality between men and women is quite important. And I think that reference is something that we do see a continuity with, but also is a big issue later on. In regards to how children are actually living at the time and social change, I think that in some ways, were the reference have been discussing children themselves, it would have had been quite important, because as we know, in 1916, 20% of deaths are under 15 years of age. So it's actually quite a big issue at the time.
Yeah, Mary, can I just bring the women's issue has been mentioned here, right? Mm-hmm. Because that was a radical position at that time as well. How central is that to the revolutionary programme?
I think it was extremely central, perhaps written out over many hundreds of decades afterwards, but certainly a lot of the women who were prominent in the 1916 Rising had been activated politically through the 1913 lockout. So there was an awareness of women who may have come from the fight for the franchise, from that movement, that there were social, enormous social problems that needed to be solved. So Sarah Ann is saying children and women, of course, were living in dire poverty. And a lot of the more well-off middle-class women who became involved in the separatist movement were motivated by the need for social change as well as by the kind of separatist agenda. So that's very clear then in their continued involvement in the trade unions later. Quite a few of them went on to play roles, not just in the War of Independence, but in later life, if they were still around, that they were involved in trying to bring about the kind of equality that was aspired to, apparently, through the proclamation of the democratic programme, but of course, as we know, wasn't delivered.
Brian, you wanted to come in there?
Yeah, I suppose just in terms of these documents, I think it's important to remember that the vast majority of rebels on Easter Monday had no input into the proclamation. And the first they heard of it was when it was unveiled by Pearce and so on at the GPO. It was written not even by the seven signatories, it was written by three or four of them. And it was never discussed by the IRB or never discussed by the Citizens' Army or the volunteers. So it's, you know, obviously somebody, something has to be written by somebody. But this had no, you know, it's the memory of the proclamation, what the proclamation is seen to mean because of the Rising, that makes it so iconic. So it's very significant that they do include women, Irish men and Irish women. And it's significant that they phrase the language the way they do. But that, too, I think can't be separated from, if you compare it to the 1867 Fenian Proclamation, that's a secular document, calls for separation of church and state and so on. This doesn't. This comes from a very different era. God is mentioned several times. Connolly's involved in writing it. He's a Marxist, but there isn't really any Marxism in the proclamation. You can read that into it if you want. But so, you know, when we talk about these documents, the Republic, I think, is the key thing that the proclamation says. You know, after 1916, that's clear. If you want independence, you want a republic. That maybe wasn't that clear before the Rising. But to try and then, you know, and we do spend, you know, we spend hours going over every word in the proclamation. By 1918, 1919, the idea of this republic was in people's minds. But every person probably had a different perception of what that republic would be about.
I think that's a really important point, Brian, because it's clear, certainly until after even the Civil War, that there was no clearly worked out programme for how the politic would be run after independence was gained. So there were various ideas that might have been based on assumptions, depending on where you came from. And there were temporary alliances that worked. But in the long run, it was really only as there was a finite organisation with the provisional government taking over that you began to see the shape of a long-term programme.
Sorry, Mary, just to cut across you there, just because you just raised something I wanted to bring in, which is how Labour was set up organisationally, because it's a very complex situation. John, maybe if you could talk about that, because we're talking about British-based trade unions, Irish trade. And then just a question, you can come back to this as well when you get back to me. To what extent would these issues, I'm talking about social issues of health, et cetera, to what extent were they political issues of the day?
Okay, I suppose first with the trade union movement and Labour Party, which it adds to its name following a decision of 1912, so it becomes the Irish Trade Union Congress and Labour Party. It dates back to 1894, and at that time and in its early years, it's dominated by craft workers, skilled workers, male mostly. Or entirely, very few, apart from the linen workers, women not really represented. Also significant that the movement is composed predominantly of unions which have their headquarters in Britain. So it's a separation, a split from the British Trade Union Congress, but it kind of is very similar to it in many respects. This begins to change, I suppose, with the establishment of the ITGWU in 1909, which itself was a split from the British-based National Union of Dock Labourers. Jim Larkin had come to Ireland a couple of years earlier as an official of that union. So with the establishment of the ITGWU, you have, I suppose, a kind of a socialist republicanism voice entering the movement and becoming quite notable over the following couple of years as the union grows and as Larkin and his fellow thinkers, if you like, begin to take over the Irish Trade Union Congress.
Brian, can I bring Brian in on something, because I talked about this before, which is the proliferation of Irish unions. And I'm thinking in particular about the work of the IRB. I mean, I understand it, the IRB was very much involved in promoting Irish unions. And of course, this wasn't necessarily to the good of the labour movement generally, Brian.
Firstly, there was a whole plethora of trade unions, dozens of them, even in just Dublin alone. And the novelty of the Irish Transport Union was that this was going to be a general union, but also an Irish union, and workers of all crafts and trades and of none could join, and had a very distinctive Irish identity. But you also then had, in the period of the War of Independence, a strong feeling on behalf of a lot of Irish Irelanders that British trade unions themselves should be driven out of Ireland, that the Irish Republican movement should use the various Irish unions to advance their cause. And there was a determined effort in the electrical trade and so on to establish Irish-based unions with IRB influence that would both, you know, negate the influence of British trade unionism, which was seen as bad per se, and also then promote the aims of Irish republicanism in various ways, including by supporting the IRA and using the tradesmen themselves and their ability to get into barracks and so on to help the Republican struggle. Now, there's always a lot of conflict about this, and it's always very messy, firstly, because the nature of craft trade unionism and so on is messy anyway. So you still have British-based unions whose members could be just as nationalistic. So it's members of the National Union of Railwaymen who are boycotting British transport in Ireland, for example. The headquarters of their union is in London. And that's important, you know, in terms of that story. But the fact that they're members of a British based trade union doesn't make them any less necessarily patriotic in Irish terms. And that continues right throughout the 20th century. And then you also have, you know, people getting entangled in these intra-union battles that, you know, might be dressed up as being about patriotism, but can be about control of certain workplaces and all the rest of it. So it is very messy. But of course, because we've been part of the United Kingdom lots of Irish trade unions had headquarters in Britain, particularly craft unions.
This reminds me of my days in Ringsend Power Station. Many, many years ago, there was a whole plethora of trade unions. My favourite was the Stationary Engine Drivers Union, if I got the name. Anyway, I digress. Now, just something else, just on the question of sort of party politics and the Labour movement. Is there an extent that the Labour Party's real rival was actually the Irish Parliamentary Party, not Sinn Féin?
Well, the Labour Party is more an aspiration, as it were, at that point. But certainly the Irish Party, it saw itself as a nationalist, as a movement, rather than a party per se. Very much opposed to any opposition, particularly from within the nationalist family, as it were, castigating opponents as splitters and so on. But it certainly, I suppose, there's a number, certainly it was seen as almost a Labour Party by the British Labour Party, with Keir Hardie and so on, visiting United Irish League branches. And it had some claim, it did promote in some ways a Labour agenda. There were a number of MPs, for example, Davitt, JP Nannetti, DD Sheehan in North Cork and so on, who identified as Labour nationalists, analogous in way to the Labour liberals in Britain who went on to establish the British Labour Party. And in terms of an actual achievement on the Labour side, and of course, they had the affiliation of the Labourers' Trade Union, the Irish Land and Labour Association. But in terms of an achievement, I suppose the most notable, which has been pointed to by Emmet O'Connor and other historians, is the Labourers' Acts, which created thousands of labourers' cottages, taking people out of hovels, essentially, throughout rural Ireland in the decades before the First World.
So they had delivered to some extent.
Well, yes, but on some other, I suppose, achievement in terms of the labourers' cottages, certainly, and in, I suppose, including the labourers within their councils in the form of the Irish Land and Labour Association and some MPs with those type of sympathies. On other issues, women's suffrage, national insurance, the record was less progressive, perhaps. Mm. And I suppose it was really, of course, Connolly argued against the those who considered the Irish Party to be a Labour Party as such. And I suppose his view would have gained more resonance, certainly at around the time of the 1913 lockout and so on, when the Irish Party or many of its MPs were kind of exposed as being not so well disposed to the rising Labour movement of the ITG.
And of course, the Irish Parliamentary Party had the advantage that it was never in government, you know, so it never had the responsibility of actually having to deliver.
Well, it Labour was... it had a similar, British governments were dependent upon it, just as, say, our outgoing government here was dependent on Fianna Fáil. They had a similar relationship with liberal governments.
Ryan, do you want to come in on that?
It was in local government, though, you know, so on Dublin Corporation, which had been nationalist since, whatever, the mid-1800s, they were the dominant force by the early 20th century, and in Dublin, of course, had appalling tenements, the worst in the United Kingdom, and this is part of the background, as we know, to the story of the lockout and so on. So the Irish Party at local level was far less in many ways. In Britain, it certainly was seen as friendly to Labour there, but in Dublin, where it was effectively in control, I think socialists would have argued that it betrayed itself as the party of the publicans and the a lot of the landlords and the shopkeepers and so on, as it was in a lot of rural Ireland too.
Republicans, Brian, sorry.
Yes, Republicans, yes. Although there were Republican publicans too, you know, but, as we'll see. So it's, you know, during the lockout, yeah, it's put to the test. And, of course, William Martin Murphy in some ways is this vision of the future, because even though he's not a Redmondite, he's a dissident home ruler, he's a Catholic nationalist leading the Dublin employers who historically were unionists. You know, he's their first Catholic nationalist leader. And in some ways, he represents one vision of Ireland of the future. And Larrikin and the Transport Union represent a different one. And that's part of the story of the pre rising era?
I think that the situation vis-a-vis the First World War meant that there was a radical change in relationships across the trade unions, the Labour Party and the IPP. And a lot of that was due to the confidence that union members had gained from suddenly there was kind of a post-war boom in the economics that meant that they were having the confidence to strike for better conditions. The IPP wouldn't have been seen as representative of ordinary people who needed to be having a radical change. But also, of course, then there would have been the aftermath of the 1916 Rising and the association of the IPP with the ruling party that had been seen to have that brutal response to the Rising. So I think there were a whole lot of issues happening over those 2 or 3 years before the War of Independence that gave rise to an altered relationship between the Labour Party and the unions, but more importantly, the union members on the ground.
I tell you, I want to move things on, and it has been mentioned already, I want to move things on to the Democratic programme. Maybe, Sarah, if you come in on this, because on the face of it, it's a pretty radical document, right? But was it just window dressing?
Before I jump into that, I might just jump into the last point to connect kind of what John was saying and Brian and Mary. I guess where you lived, because there is such an emphasis on health and welfare in the preceding 10 years, and be that in legislation or in regards to, you know, different changes, as John pointed out, living in rural areas is statistically healthier at this point. And I think some of what we're looking at here in regards to the conditions. And at the moment, I think it's quite interesting if we look at the question of disease, labour laws, all the different changes that came through, because obviously if you are living in a tenement in Dublin, you're so much more limited in many of the measures they're trying to encourage, be it improving in hygiene, sanitation, everything else. So even though TB is still the greatest killer around this time, we also have lots of changes in regards to vaccinations. So I think this is the broad social changes, like Mary has said, and then questioning the impact of the First World War into the Spanish flu is really part of this discussion. On the Democratic programme, I suppose in many ways it's a political philosophy, but to pick up on what Brian said earlier, it is a document that's primarily drafted by three members of the Labour Party, with I think Seanty O'Kelly taking some of the edges off it. So it's probably more about whether it could be implemented later on, and whether even the Parliament at that time would have been in agreement with the left-wing principles of it. And I guess it leads to that question of to what extent many Republicans are left-wing in their own political thinking. So it's not really, I wouldn't call it window dressing. I would just be more interested in even though it is unanimously supported on paper, to what extent actually members agreed with what was there. And also, could it have been more radical would be a question I would have if you're looking internationally at the time.
I mean, I've made this point several times. Should we always be suspicious of anything that is adopted unanimously? Here's a question. You know, that if something is accepted on a very tight vote after a ferocious row and argument, it is much more, you know, it's worth a lot more than something that's passed on the nod. So that's why I
guess you have to question, is there legislative power at that time
to
put in these principles? If not, it's far too many similarities with right now, to be honest. I don't know, can I have this conversation about programs of government?
Can I ask a dumb question here? What's in it? Can you just remind our listeners, what's the gist of the Democratic programme? What does it say?
The problem been pointed out that there's no firm commitments in it except one, and that's to the abolition of the workhouse system. A lot of the rest of it, it's in social democratic language, but it avoids firm commitments.
That was done to Scotland, wasn't it? The workhouses were abolished just by simply abolishing the name.
Indeed, yes.
And, but the institutions continued.
I don't think we want to get into that here, but I mean, that leads us into debates like about mother and baby homes and so on. So the abolition of the workhouse system at the stroke of a pen, which was the commitment of the solid commitment of the democratic program, didn't have an entirely a positive outcome in all respects, because the transition wasn't thought through. Sorry,
Ryan, do you want to come in on that?
Well, no, I think part of the importance of it is that it exists and that the labour movement were important enough to be asked to produce it, because Sinn Féin were ruthlessly pragmatic. They wanted both international recognition, and the socialist movement was becoming tremendously important in the post-war world. They thought if the Irish labour movement could present Ireland's case for independence to international socialism, this would be of benefit. About sovereignty. And also, the fact is that labour movement had been dealt very bad blows prior to the war, particularly in the lockout and so on. The transport union had been down to a few thousand members by 1916. But from 1917 onwards, Labour in general and the Irish Transport Union in particular are becoming a major force. And I think it's kind of always forgotten, because we put so much emphasis on Connolly and the Citizens' Army and so on, that a union led by far less illustrious characters in some ways became a mass force. You know, the transport union has 120,000 members by 1919-1920. Half of them are farm labourers, so it's reaching parts of Ireland that the unions were historically not able to reach, in a lot of cases are assumed couldn't reach. So the unions are important players, and the Labour Party and Trade Union Congress needs to be at least, brought on board by the Republican movement in many ways. So the democratic programme is both for international opinion, but also in terms of Labour being seen to have a place in the new Ireland.
Yeah, I think there are, I would agree with what's been said so far, but you can't separate it from the international situation in particular. I mean, the one thing about the democratic programmes, it seems that most of the members of that first sitting of the Dáil hadn't actually had an opportunity to read it, so they were certainly rubber stamping it without examining it. But there may well have been, in addition to the recognition of the numbers in Ireland, from about 1919, certainly into the early 1920s, there was a huge wave of labour activation across Europe, and very much left-wing directed movements, apart from the Russian Revolution, which was obvious. There were particular, say, the Vienna Rossa in Italy and various other uprisings, including the Ruhr in Germany. So I would say it's highly unlikely that people were not conscious of that. I mean, even 1918 in Dublin, there were mass meetings to celebrate the Russian Revolution, both the Menshevik and the Bolshevik. So there probably was a concern among those who were less socialistically inclined, shall I say, that Labour actually had more power than it did at the time, but there obviously was too clear support for a movement forward. And I think this is where you come back to the use of Soviets as a way of having industrial action rather than just strikes, which must have been influenced by knowledge of what had happened in Russia.
Yeah, John, can I bring you in on this? Because the term Soviet, when the problem with Soviet, it's like swallow, one swallow and you think of a whole summer. One Soviet and, there's a revolution on the way. Just could you explain what it means, right, in general, and what it meant in the Irish context? And I'd like to tease out the point that Mary just raised, the difference between a strike and a Soviet.
Well, I guess, first of all, what's a Soviet? The word is, people would probably know, is borrowed, borrowing from Russia. It simply means council, but it was the, workers' councils were used by the Bolsheviks in 1917 in their assumption of power. Now, the word itself, kind of much like boycott, went out from Ireland in the 1880s. Sabotage was adopted from about 1910, coming out of France. Soviet was kind of, the meaning was vague enough. And in the Irish context, the impression is that it was used initially pejoratively. certainly with regard to the Limerick Soviet, probably the best known. It was, I think, first referred to as such in the Irish Times, which was not well disposed, let's say, to the
Limerick Soviet. It's a pejorative term originally.
Originally, but then which was clearly adopted by some of the radicals themselves, as you can see in the slogan of the Not Long and Brewery Soviets, we make bread, not profits. You know, Limerick, and that was the Not Long Creamery Soviet self-style. But it's, in terms of what they were, I suppose they cover a variety of different phenomena from the Limerick Soviet, which involved the taking over by the labour body of affairs in Limerick for a couple of weeks, to more flash-in-the-pan episodes like Liam O'Flaherty's unemployed Soviet in the rotunda in Dublin. I suppose in terms of what they actually meant, I suppose in practice, seizing and holding for a period a town or a premises or a mine, as the case of Arigna, which I think was about the longest one on the Leitrim Roscommon border, which went on for 2 months, I think, in 1921. So essentially there, and I suppose the context of them and the fact that the seizures take place and that they go on for days or weeks or whatever, is also reflects the state of affairs in the country, the departure of the RIC, say, from a lot of rural Ireland. So people could take the law into their own hands or make their own law at that particular point.
There's a law
but
and
it
order
doesn't seem, in general, though there were some people involved in the Munster, rural Munster Soviets, the Creamery Soviets and so on, who were self-styled Bolsheviks. In general, they seem to have been kind of strategic in winning short-term claims, wage increases, and the likes. And as regards how extensive they were, again, it's difficult to measure. The figure 100 plus has been mentioned, but again, it's difficult to count in terms of the numbers that people where people would have embraced the term, as it were, rather than it being used in the local media, perhaps in a pejorative sense.
Just briefly, I mean, there's very vivid descriptions in the Irish Transport Union's reports from the April 1920 general strike to free the hunger strikers in Mountjoy, which is a national strike. In a lot of places, you know, like Rathangan, Bagnallstown, Virginia, County Cavan, Maynooth, places where, again, you wouldn't associate with the labour movement. There's big strikes, and invariably in these reports, you know, from Bagnallstown, they say, on the second day of the strike, we held a public meeting in the Market Square and publicly proclaimed the establishment of a provisional Soviet government. In Tralee, the Trades Council was turned into a Workers' Council and we took full control of everything. You know, so the idea that Workers' Councils take control and that they call themselves Soviets is out there. Mm-hmm. So people do adopt this idea. Now, that strike lasts 2 days. It's tremendously successful and we would have had a centenary celebration had we not all been locked down, hopefully, in the last couple of weeks. But so the term is out there and that does reflect confidence and also the international atmosphere, obviously.
Yeah. Okay, well, this is getting to the nub of this thing now, because the point is that the 1920 general strike demonstrates the potential power of the labour movement, right? But the point is, it's a power they're exercising on behalf of a different social force, i.e., you know, the national movement, Sinn Féin. Right. Like, its big mobilizations is always for somebody else's agenda, never for its own agenda. Like, I mean,
not sure it's quite as simple as that. I mean, there's a number of mobilizations over the period, which might be seen to have a purely nationalist objective or a mainly nationalist objective, from the anti-conscription strike, which obviously served a nationalist cause. But obviously, conscription is of concern to Labour as well, and anti-conscription movement in Australia, for example, was led by Labour and feminists. With regard to the Limerick Soviet, likewise, it was in opposition essentially to martial law and to the British army, but yet it was still about the right to go to your job without having to present this vexatious permit on your way. And even if we take up 1920, and the strike in relation to the hunger strikers in 1920, some of the hunger strikers were actual transport union organisers. Jack Headley, who was one of the self-styled Bolsheviks of the Munster agitation, was one of them, I think, and there were a number of other union officials. So it's not an entirely... there's overlapping elements to it, if you like.
Frank Gallagher was one of the hunger strikers. And after his release, he went back to his job as a journalist. And he wrote a piece in May 1920 about the meaning of the hunger strike. And essentially, he was saying, maybe in rather rosy terms, as a recognition of the people of Ireland recognising their common nationality, but also their common interests. So it's almost, you know, ignoring the class element, but at the same time, he is recognising, and this is somebody who wasn't coming from the trade union background, talking about the influence of the labour movement and their capacity to use those tools. I mean, I would think that the key thing about Soviets as opposed to strikes is that it is coming from below and that it's seizing control by the people who are most affected by what's going on, where a strike will be of the same thing, but necessarily organised by officials for the most part. But that's kind of hindsight and looking backwards rather than how it might have been seen at the time.
Mary, this actually brings me on to the another item in our title here, which is the question of land seizures, right? John, just talk to us about that. I mean, I'm talking here about cattle drives, land seizures. Yeah. And how does a land seizure work? In other words, if somebody, how do you, you know, it's one thing to seize land, but how do you hold on to it, right? I mean, how does that work on the ground?
Yeah, well, I suppose this is, it's not new, but I suppose what is, we've had land seizures of one sort before, cattle drives and the like, but a contagion, as it were, swept the country, certainly. About 100 years ago, these months, March to June, roughly 1920, emanating, as did the Land League and so on, from the west of Ireland, from Galway and Mayo. And I suppose agriculture had a boom time during the war. There's a kind of assumption in the narrative of Irish history generally, the land question is solved early in the first decade or so of the century. But there's still many grievances, in particular among those who feel left out by the settlement, people without land, or so-called congists who hadn't enough to raise their families on. In the West in particular, there was focus on graziers who sublet land on the 11-month system. So their land became a particular target in 1920, which Kevin O'Sheill, who was the Trinity-educated barrister who was kind of sent out by Dáil Éireann to sort all this out, he said it was on a more extensive scale than any land movement since the early 1880s. So that gives some, and it reached across about the western half of Ireland, broadly speaking. Now, as with the Soviets, and it included Soviets, the Broadford Soviet was essentially the seizure of a land in County Clare. That was essentially a land seizure and a division among the community. But a major device essentially was making life impossible for the graziers to hold on to these tracts which people needed to survive. So they use essentially driving the graziers' cattle away at night many miles and just leaving them on the road, essentially, or to cause irritation. There was kind of an interesting one I'll mention because my grandfather was in the thick of it. This was in Corandonna on the shores of Loch Corrib in County Galway when the county sheriff of County Galway, who was a local landowner, mill owner, a man called James Alcorn, was taken to the shores of the lake and dunked in the lake and told he'd be going in permanently in 2 minutes if he didn't sign over the land holding.
And signed over, that's I'm getting at here, you know, the legality.
Yeah. But there is... there's a variety of devices, as I said, used, but it's of great concern to the Sinn Féin because it's seen as socially divisive. It's people taking the law into their own hands. The Dáil is trying to assert its authority with Dáil courts and so on. So its solution here is to establish a system more or less parallel to the Dáil courts, which were land courts. And we have this account from Kevin O'Shiel, as I said, of his involvement. And it's kind of, they use a system of arbitration where they take account of the claims of the usually larger farmer or landlord. And sometimes, and O'Shiel gives an example from around Ballinrobe, County Mayo, where if the the militant tenants don't accept the ruling of the court, and many of them were reluctant to do so, they would have had a visit in the middle of the night from loyal members of the IRA. But of course, it divided the IRA as well. And in particular, there's an account from to which Michael Collins paid some attention to in March 1920 in Connemara, where the boycotted people are prominent people in the Republican movement related to Páirc O'Maolaí and the Sinn Féin MP and so on. And what this produced is a division between Sinn Féin and the IRA. So the IRA are going around acting in a kind of involved in the boycotting and the seizures, whereas Sinn Féin are kind of defending the rights of the owners, the shopkeepers, and so on.
Just before I want to develop this discussion on the Dáil courts, but just before I do, Brian, I want to come back to you because on the question of criminality, and I choose my words carefully here because a lot of what John has just been describing here could be described or could, you know, fade into and be regarded as criminality. And I'm assuming that with a guerrilla war going on, law and order is breaking down in many parts of the country.
Yeah, there is a breakdown in law and order, particularly in late 1919 into early 1920. And what the problem for the Republicans and for the Dáil is this. I mean, they're leading a revolution against the British government and the British Empire. And the British are continually denouncing them as terrorists and as a murder gang. And also then there's all the prejudice about the fact that the Irish just wouldn't be able to govern themselves. So the Dáil has to a great extent, appear very respectable. And this plays out into how the Dáil courts operate as well. They don't want a breakdown of law and order. They don't want criminality. And there is all kinds of ordinary crime, so to speak, going on at the time as well. There definitely is a crime wave, certainly in comparison to what had existed beforehand when there'd been relatively little ordinary crime, to some extent anyway. So the Dáil establishes a Republican police, which is largely, in the early stages, just the IRA, but it becomes a slightly separate force later on, who, in lots of cases, recover stolen money and give it back to the people it's been stolen from. Famously, in Mill Street in Cork, a bank is robbed, £20,000 taken, which is big, big money in 1919. And the IRA get the money back and give it back to the bank. And they do that a lot. They deport a lot of people because they don't have prisons. What they do very little is kill people. The IRA very rarely kills criminals in that era. But they do arrest lots of people, try and clamp down on gangs in Dublin and elsewhere, and are very keen to be appreciated by respectable community. So you've got a whole, you know, lots of cases of unionist landowners who praise the IRA for clamping down on crime, or who praise the Dáil courts for being fair. And the Republicans play this up an enormous amount, because again, they're being assailed as people who are anarchists. So they're keen to say, no, look, we're absolutely, we've got Lord Mounteagle saying the Sinn Féin courts are better than the normal courts. We've got unionist employers in Kilkenny saying, you know, we had all sorts of trouble, but the Republican police solved it and the RIC weren't able to do it. So there's this constant, you know, battle going on in terms of what's happening on the ground between revolutionary instincts and also those who are saying, well, you know, if we want to get international recognition, particularly from the United States and so on, we want to win over opinion in Britain, we can't let things go to hell. We can't let the appearance of anarchy, at least, run rampant.
Isn't that, in terms of what the objective here is, which is sovereignty and independence, isn't that good politics?
Can the case be made that the Dáil courts were amazingly successful for what their function was? And their function wasn't to foment social revolution. Their function was to keep the lid on things.
I think initially there was an element of both. Certainly, I mean, when the first Dáil sat, and then the Dáil courts evolved out of the arbitration courts for land seizures and other, land-related issues. I'd say mainly the intention was to assume the appearance of a legitimate state. So you had the infrastructure of the state would obviously include a court system. And over 1919 and 20, they took over in a sense that the assizes couldn't, where most criminal cases would be heard, couldn't really take place because most of the RIC had been either boycotted out of the local areas or were simply intimidated. But either way, the forces of normal peacekeeping and criminality suppression weren't being effective. But yes, of course, too, there was that element of being seen to be highly successful and being respected for what they were. But they weren't being allowed to do this by the British authorities. I mean, they were subject to raids consistently. I mean, it wasn't until after the truce that they were able to operate openly. And that's when I think in that period of 6 months or so until the treaty is signed, you really see them come into their own. But, I mean, there's the famous scene in The Wind That Shakes the Barley.
I was going to mention that.
Unfortunately, much as I love the way it's portrayed, it really wouldn't have been very accurate reflection of what would have happened in those courts. There was an infamous incident from my point of view from Austin Stack, who was the Minister for Home Affairs, who had been put in charge of the Dáil courts as opposed to the previous arbitration courts, which came under agriculture. The thing about Austin Stack was that incident that's reproduced in the film with the money lender being given back, to being told the woman, the poor woman has to pay her debt because they need him. That actually happened in Dublin, but part of it wasn't so much because they needed his money, but because it was the legal situation. They were going by the laws that existed at the time that they declared themselves a republic, which of course was the British legal system. And as Sarah Ann said in another context, at that stage, they really weren't in a position to pass laws. And although they had departments for various things, they were clandestine for the most part until the truce happened. And that's when you start to see the shape of the state. And of course, all went totally, unfortunately, pear-shaped in the following year with the breakdown.
Isn't it interesting that for all their conservativeness, the Dáil courts I'm talking about here, one of the first things the Free State government was to abolish them.
Well, I mean, is that a backhanded compliment
in a sense?
It is, but at the same time, it's also black propaganda over the years. And I think Kevin O'Higgins in particular would have led the charge on that. When you're looking at the various Dáil debates about not just the Dáil courts, but you know, various issues in relation to the justice system while he was there, it's very much making the anti-treaty people out to be more politically left than they actually were. So they were tarring the Dáil Courts with that kind of label as a way of distancing themselves from the anti-treaty forces, who, as we know, you know, really were a very mixed bag and didn't have, you know, it wasn't a socialist enterprise, that their objection was totally on the selling out of the idea of the Republic as they had been fighting for.
When I try to look the question out here is, why does that misunderstanding persist? And I'm talking about the misunderstanding that, the anti-treaty side are inherently more radical socially. Brian, do you want to comment on that? Is that a fair observation to make, by the way?
Well, I think there's this whole process taking place during the War of Independence and the Civil War, where both in the West on the land and in the East among farm labourers, which are is a different phenomenon, and in other parts of the country, you have this tremendous militancy. And some of it is linked to the national struggle and some of it isn't. And that kind of continues on into the Civil War period and does become intertwined at a local level very often, with the Free State government seeing every strike as a harbinger of Bolshevism and therefore likely to aid the anti-treatyites. And people like Liam Lynch, the anti-treaty IRA chief of staff, who initially isn't that interested in these things, does ultimately conclude that the more trouble there is for the Free State, whether it's strikes or land agitation and so on, it might help bring them down. And Liam Mellows, I think, also comes relatively late to this idea of embracing social radicalism. In the longer run, why? Well, one, I think people need something to believe in. And I think we downplay how important sovereignty was because there's a lot of disappointment with what sovereignty bought. So we forget that in 1920, the idea of Ireland actually winning a degree of sovereignty from the British Empire seems still pretty crazy. We're disappointed for very good reasons by what comes after. And I think therefore people on the left in particular look at the Civil War and see this, is this great missing opportunity for revolution? And I think that there is a lot going on in terms of class, a lot of radicalism there, but it's not easily put into boxes of the anti-treatyites are the left-wingers and the pro-treatyites are, of course, the capitalists, even though most of them are. And then you also have Labour, because where is Labour in all of this? And there's an irony that the Democratic Programme is held up as this great document, the missing thread, when it was written by Thomas Johnson, you know, who by 1923 is despised by Republicans for supposedly propping up the Free State. And I think maybe some of this is down to the omnipresence of Padraig O'Donnell's work, you know, who really is taken at face value in terms of what he writes about the Civil War, when again, you've got to, like, you know, say, well, Labour are a bit of a different thing. And, you know, you talk about general strikes. Well, in 1922, there's a very successful general strike in the spring of 1922 against the drift to civil war. Now, implicitly, it's in favour of the treaty because it's saying, right, we're going to have to deal with this. And Republicans, of course, write this off as treachery. But it's a huge general strike, and you just don't get, as for God's sake, we had 10 years of austerity when everybody was talking about general strikes. We never had one. They're not easy to organise. This is a big event. It wouldn't have happened unless thousands of workers were a little bit outside all of this debate. Like Labour in 1922 get a huge vote in that treaty election, and Labour are not really part of the argument. So there may be lots of working class people who, you know, are thinking somewhat outside the box in terms of the treaty split and so on. Now, that's not really answering your question, but I think that it's part of this story that's not easily explicable in terms of the labels, maybe.
Andrea, I just want to come in on that. I mean,
I think, like, just, and again, not answering your question, but I think it's also about the historiography. And I think some of the more recent historiography, and especially kind of the micro studies, or like I'm thinking of like Fionnuala Walsh's work on women in the First World War, she shows that while the effects of the First World War are actually not positive for Irish women, so later on into the 20s, as Mary alluded to, there isn't that bounce. It had a huge effect on them at the time. So it's actually about like people's experiences at that time. Sometimes we're looking at what came afterwards and we're reflecting back. But I think that's kind of quite important. And I think as well with the recent studies on the Spanish flu, we're seeing that as well. So I think it's just about trying to piece, you know, the personal experiences during that time. Like Brian says, another question is how many working class people are actually involved in the Republican movement, but may have the you know, maybe that way minded, they just may not have the actual, be able to afford to be involved in that kind of activism. So I think there's some of the issues that would be coming through for me.
Now, just to wrap things up, we get towards the end here. My question about the assumed social radicalism of the anti-treaty side, I just want to turn that on its head, because I think we can say that the pro-treaty side did represent conservative forces at the time. I presume we're agreed on that. And they are the forces who prevailed ultimately. So if you're looking at Ireland after the Civil War, 1923, it's a very conservative place. But then again, so is everywhere in Europe. It seems to me that their emphasis quite often on how everything went pear-shaped, you know, went conservative, et cetera, et cetera. But people don't take into account, well, this is what was happening everywhere, you know, so should we stop beating ourselves up about this?
I think the point that Sarah Ann has just made is extremely important, that it is about how people felt at the time. So I wouldn't say that all pro-treaty people were necessarily socially conservative, particularly for those who were kind of caught up in the viciousness of so many years of war and hardship. I suspect a lot of people would have voted for the treaty simply to have a period of peace and a chance to catch their breath, you know, for a while. Mm-hmm. It wasn't necessarily a vote for or against. It would simply be, you know, can we just stop for a while?
That's the argument used by the priest giving the sermon in The Wind That Shakes the Barley. Brian, you want to come in there?
Yeah, just ironically, I mean, during the treaty debates itself, the Democratic programme's only mentioned once, as far as I can see. And it's mentioned by Joe McGrath, a pro-treatyite, who says under this treaty, we'll be able to put into effect the measures in the democratic programme. Now, there's a great irony in that, because there are some people, of course, McGrath had been involved with the transport union as well. Now, during the Civil War, he's centrally involved in a very brutal death squad in Dublin, you know, but nobody on the anti-treaty side during the treaty debate says we need the democratic programme. Later on, Mellows does say it when he's in jail. So I think there is, you know, this great, you know, confusion and complexity, but also there's the lived experience of so many people. And this is where class is important, I suppose, because ordinary working class people to a great extent didn't have voices, or we've got to really delve in to try and discover to how they experienced these events. And, you know, to a great extent, the leadership of the Republican movement were very literate people, and there's all kinds of records about them. But the so-called rabble of the towns and so on, you know, the people who lived in the lanes, the people who are dismissed in the literature, the tramps and the tinkers and so on, you know, how do we discover what they thought, how they experienced the revolution? And people like Sarah Ann and so on are trying to do that. But it will be part of the story, I suppose, as we go on. But again, we tend to think, well, Labour is one bloc, Republicans are another bloc, so on, these things. But they're actually much more, you know, fluid than that, I think, at the time. And I've used this phrase a lot. It's Ernie O'Malley's phrase about class in Ireland being like the layers of an onion. I mean, you know, it isn't just workers, bosses, or the middle class. There's so many gradations in rural Ireland and so on, farmers, labourers, shopkeepers, and so on, and all these things. And they all really mattered. People were very aware of class.
John, do you want to come back on that, the international situation, like post-1923?
Well, I suppose there's a number of things which change in Ireland and internationally. There's the post-war economic downturn, which is one thing, which is an international phenomenon, but it affects labour and the confidence of labour and labour's capacity to act independently. So I suppose the defeat of the transport union in rural Ireland in Leinster and
what are you referring to there, John? Just give us a detail on that. What defeat are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about farm labourers defeats and the withdrawal of big strikes in Kildare, Waterford and so on, where the recently the group which joined the transport union that Brian referred to earlier as half essentially of the transport union at its peak, they essentially are defeated in conflict with farmers in a number of disputes. And so essentially that ITGWU abandons rural Ireland in consequence, and Labour is reduced pretty much to not much more in a couple of years than it had been in the aftermath of the 1913 lockout, with feuding and so on, as Jim Larkin comes back from the United States as a out of jail and so on, and as a leader of the international communist movement at that stage, contributing to a factionalism that occurred. But it was a reflection, I suppose, of the broader situation of a shrinking movement, and you have conflict, ideological, personal, and also between Irish and British trade unions in that period.
Brian, is there also a very bitter? Sorry, John. Is there a very bitter postal strike? I think 1923, is that correct?
Indeed, and there's a dock strike
in 22.
Yeah.
So these are all defeats for the Labour movement.
Mm-hmm. These are defeats.
Several of them.
In general, I suppose what you had, the reason for the growth in the Labour movement was arose from wartime, high demand for labour, and high inflation and so on. So everybody needed to get a wage increase, and unions had the bargaining power. Labour in general had the bargaining power through in a context of full employment and so on. This changed in the aftermath of the war, and the change, I suppose, the loss of Labour's power on the ground in Ireland was delayed somewhat by the general commotion in the countryside and the loss of the authority of the old state, as it were. But it certainly came at this period towards the end of the War of Independence and into the Civil War period. Yeah.
Brian, I want to come to you for a final comment on this, which you've made several times before, because quite often in discussions like this, the assumption is that what happens by 1923-24 represents a great betrayal, you know, of the Irish Revolution. You don't go along with that view, because in many ways people got what they'd been fighting for to some extent.
Yeah, I suppose, again, it's not necessarily what I would have wanted or what I think I might have wanted had I been around. But we do tend to take for granted that Irish independence was inevitable and that the British were always going to concede, even what they did concede. And that's by no means, you know, you cannot take that for granted in 1918, that the independence movement really is a huge, tremendous effort in which the labour movement plays a big part, which has often been unrecognised or distorted. And again, unfortunately, we're just not, at the moment, we can't talk about the significance of the April 1920 general strike, you know, in a public way, unfortunately. And you have the boycott of military transport and so on. And Irish labour is an important part of that struggle. But I think what held the coalition together was this idea of sovereignty. It was by no means guaranteed they would get any of that. And to do that, they really had to take on the might of the British Empire. And that shouldn't be forgotten in terms of the disappointment of how it works out. And also then we shouldn't assume that all of these people were tremendously disappointed. I mean, some were, but, you know, an enormous part of the revolutionary movement ended up in either Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil. You know, we can trace their careers because we can, you know, track where people went. And both those parties were the pillars of the state once the Civil War was over and a decade later, at least. And therefore, I think there may have been the potential for something else, but it's not quite clear that the treaty and so on is the end of the revolution in that sense. I think you've got to really try and delve into these other questions about class and about what the way that the Republican movement tried to present itself in terms of its worldview, to see really whether there was that impulse and whether it ever really was a potential outcome.
Anybody else want to come in before I wrap up? If not, I just want to say
briefly. I'm kind of thinking, you know, I don't often find myself apologising or in any way for coming to nail or any of the forces at that stage. But I think in some ways we were lucky that while there was disappointment, there were maybe expectations, there were expectations not met. But when you look what happened in other parts of Europe with the rise of fascism, it could have been so much worse.
Yeah, and can I just put in a final good word for sovereignty, because we're seeing it demonstrated at the moment in relation to the COVID-19 thing, the difference in death rates and contamination rates between this island and the neighbouring island, right? So I'll leave that positive thought with you listeners. Listen, I'd just like to thank everyone for this, you know, as I say, we're on the frontiers of technology here, right? Our first ever Zoom Head School. So I'd like to thank our panel here, Brian Hanley, Sarah Ann Buckley, Mary Muldowney, and John Cunningham. And we hope you'll tune in again, listeners. There's a great podcast I actually did with Brian in relation to the general election. We did weeks ago, and we still don't have a government. So it's still current, it's still hot. If you go onto our website, you'll get it there. So do tune in for the next Head School, which will be marking the bicentenary of the death of Henry Grattan. And that was on that'll be the 6th of June, this coming 6th of June. So keep an eye out for that. So thank you all very much for tuning in, and I hope to talk to you again. Thank you.